Good. Well, good evening. It's great to be here. And there are quite a few things that I'm passionate about. And having worked in system engineering for many years, it is really something that I enjoy. And I was telling somebody just now that, you know, since I was this size, I wanted to become an engineer. And it's awesome to be able to do that every day. And my original title was Why Systems Engineering on Salt. But I think Paul is actually very good in summarizing it, because it is a non-defense project. And many people ask the question, why the heck would you do systems engineering on that? And at that stage, in the telescope world, people were not using systems engineering as a rule. We were one of the first telescopes in the world to actually do systems engineering. And Kobus Meiring, who was the project manager that you guys met in this November, was the project manager for SALT. And I wanted to get out of the rat race in Gauteng, and so I was looking for an opportunity in Cape Town, and SALT looked like one of those opportunities. And he really gave me a lot of free rein to apply systems engineering on the telescope. So I could define the development process, I could define a lot of the strategy, the document numbering system, what documents are required, and what is needed from every team to actually deliver. But before I get ahead of myself, maybe I should go to my presentation. So these are some of the projects that I've worked on. And it's really an awesome privilege. And I don't want to try and stand here and pretend that I'm things I'm not. And I cannot take the credit for making these things happen. It's all about team and people. But it's been a wonderful journey and a lot of learning to be really working with top-class international people on many of these projects. My company, AlphaDot, really has a passion around job creation. And it's job creation around manufacturing, because that's when you really start getting jobs. This is a graph that comes from the IDC showing how the service contribution to our GDP in South Africa has grown since 1980. And for many people, they say, oh, that's good, because it's job creation and whatever, but it's displacing other things, which I'll come to now. And it sort of followed the trend of the world, except it's even more. And if you compare it to the other developing countries, it's a lot higher. And that's mostly the cell phone industry, cell phone and banking, which is considered the service industry. If you look at manufacturing, where the real jobs are, that's what's happened at the same time. And a lot of that is because South Africa has lost intellectual property. We are not developing new products outside the defense to a large extent. I'm generalizing a lot, but that I think is at the heart of the problem. And if you look at this graph showing the exports of products from South Africa as a percentage of the total, motor vehicles, fantastic. No South African intellectual property, or very little. Iron and steel, vehicle parts, da-da-da. When you get to the blue arrow, that's when you get the real first South African product, which is being exported in substantial quantities. Now, these bins are not individual products. They are the export codes that are used by the Department of Trade and Industry. And what I would want to see is a lot more growth to the left of South African products in general. And I really believe it can make a huge impact on our economy. So the passion for my company is really job creation through newly developed South African products being manufactured locally. And that's really what I mean with my sort of tagline there, high impact innovation. So it's working in those areas that can actually have that scale of impact. So just one slide on the company itself, what we do. I don't want to say too much about it, but it's really applying systems engineering and development management skills that I've developed over the years with collaborators, especially in those fields. AlphaDot is sort of the mothership. We have EDAPT, which is focusing mostly on data security for small businesses. Batco, also a fairly new company, mostly lithium-ion batteries, although there are other batteries that are creeping in, and then a lot of consulting, which we're doing. So the sort of next chapter of my talk is why system engineering is important and why it helps solve that problem. And I'm not going to try and be too clever about it. It's really just some basic numbers which I use when I go to managers and try and explain to them why they should have a system engineering budget and why it makes sense. And I'm sure many of you have read these studies or know about it, but this was the one thing that really got me going, must have been about 20 years ago, when I read this study, which is done by the Software Engineering Institute many years ago, where they surveyed many companies in the United States. And they said, what does it cost to write a program of 200,000 lines of software? And it was similar complexity software that the different companies were doing. And the amazing thing was the huge spread of effort that these companies quoted and actually delivered for the work, going from 595 man months to 16 man months for the same software. And then they said, why is this? What can actually cause that? And they came up with this whole SPICE categorization of companies where they get different maturity levels and they try to distinguish what are those things that certain companies do that others do not do. And a lot of that is just a systematic way of thinking, documenting, having design reviews, writing down what your customer wants, having records, having documentation. And it's really a top-down process being implemented in stages in this thing. And ISO 9001 puts 90% of the things that they actually have in there into a process, or at least a guideline for a company to start using. And this is not directly system engineering speak, but it's talking about the same type of thing. The second study that made quite an impression on me is a guy by the name of Boom. I don't know if that's the right pronunciation. He wrote a book called Economics of Software. He's at the University of Southern California. But they looked at the defense projects and they said, okay, why are certain defense projects overspending? What is the core reason for them failing? And they looked at the cost of fixing a defect when you find it in the requirements phase versus what it costs you when the product is in operation. And these were many complex projects. So that's the black line. And you can see on the right, it's about a fact 200. More expensive to fix the problem in operation compared to one in the requirements phase. So if you are skipping phases, then you're obviously just increasing your risk. And then for smaller projects, it's not quite as harsh as that. That's the green line, but it's still true. So my philosophy is the principles of system engineering should actually be in every product development. It's not just for complex systems. There are certain basics of writing a specification, doing a design, doing a review, the type of things that we as system engineers do and bring to the table that every single engineer should actually be taught and should be doing. And any company that does product development should actually be doing those things. That's sort of my mantra, and I might say it a few times more this night tonight. The reason behind that is as you get increasing complexity, so the moment it's more than fits into one person's head, you get an increasing number of risks jumping up. So as the number of components forming a system increase, And I mean, you guys know this, so I'm just going to go through this very quickly. You need more money, so the stakes are higher. More people, the consequence of failure is higher. More interfaces, more systems, and it really means the risk goes up. So there's an increasing need for a structured multidisciplinary engineering approach. And so when we were really starting SALT, we had a lot of discussions with the astronomer community and convinced them, okay, but SALT was in that category. And as I go through some of the presentation now, I hope you'll see that it really is a very complex system with a lot of demands that really justified us doing that. But it didn't mean there was much investment. So it was a really very heavily tailored system engineering process. I did not use the system engineering handbook. I don't think it existed at that time. I did not use my MIL standards. A lot of it was just sitting, what makes sense? Let's put a process together and make things work. What I'm going to show you is really gleaned from three different presentations that I've given over the years at various conferences relating to SALT. But I've got a lot of co-authors there, which I have to acknowledge in this process. If you look at SALT today, these are the organizations that are part of it. So it's actually a Pty Limited, but it's got lots of different shareholders. South Africa owns about 30% of the telescope, and each funder has use of SALT in the percentage of its shareholding, depending on how much it's contributed. And you can see there it's from all over the world. And so they actually purchase a time window on SALT to use it. This is what the site looked like before SALT was built. This photo is taken from where SALT stands today. The youngest telescope there that actually belonged to South Africa, there was a recent UK one that they built, but the youngest telescope at that time there was from before the Second World War. So that was the level of the technology within the South African astronomical community. And SALT is the largest telescope in the Southern Hemisphere, the third largest in the world. So it is a huge leap. None of the team had ever built a telescope before. In fact, when I visited there after being appointed, it was the first time I'd actually seen one from close by. So it is a huge learning curve. There's the sort of money we were talking about for the actual telescope, 18 million for the scientific instrumentation, 4.5, and then we had to budget in the first 10 years of operation. So we had a fixed budget for operation from day one. So we had to engineer to that cost as well. Which is quite an interesting problem. There was a board. The scientific community was represented by what we called the Science Working Group. So they were the technical representatives of the customer. And it was a committee comprising all these different institutions. And I had to report there as system engineer and say, this is what we're doing. They helped me write the specification. They provided their scientific requirements, and I had to actually translate that into technical requirements for the telescope. The project manager is in the middle of the block there. Next to him on the left is a project scientist. So that was a local scientist that is the lead scientist on the project. So he's the first interface if there's a science question. And then the community that made the instruments, the scientific instruments, which were mostly from these universities that were shareholders. And then the team at the bottom, the numbers in brackets are the number of people in those teams. So within my systems engineering team, we were three. I had an optical designer, a Polish guy, who was very skilled, and I had somebody that helped me with the interface control. And that was it. And I was also responsible for the telescope control system, and there we had a team of eight people writing software. But once again, it is all about teamwork. So there were many, many contracts, and a lot of the stuff is not available in South Africa. The I'm going to come to the telescope design in a moment, but the primary mirror, which is the first thing that the light hits after coming very, very far, is 10 meters in diameter. And it comprises 91 individual segments, which have to be aligned very precisely. But it's not normal glass. It has to be thermally stable, so it cannot expand and shrink and deform as a result of temperature. So it's a very special ceramic that came from Russia that was polished into its spherical shape by Kodak. Because it's spherical and the sphere doesn't focus properly, we had to have a thing called a spherical aberration corrector, which was a four-element optical device that Sajam made. First local big company, BKS Advantech in Pretoria, did the structure and the dome. The tracker was done here by Roytech Radar Systems in Stellenbosch. And there's a long list. But the edge sensors, I'm going to show you a bit more about it, were done by a French company. But the integration and testing was done in-house. The system analysis and design was done in-house. And the software for the telescope control system was done in-house. I don't think it's on the list there. So this is really the concept of SALT. A normal telescope has the ability to point anywhere on the sky. But when you get to such a big telescope, to give you an example or an idea, this structure weighs 80 tons. Okay, the outside structure. If I have to point that from horizontal to vertical, you can imagine the stresses in that steel and the amount of deformation. But you're talking about light, okay? Nanometers, 630 nanometer wavelength is red light. So you need to focus the incoming light here to a point within 6 microns, okay? And you have to keep it there as the Earth rotates, which is for hours on end, and you need to be able to follow that particular frame on the sky during that whole period and not blur the image that you're taking or distort the science. Because you're trying to look at faint objects. That's why you're building such a big telescope, is to look fainter and fainter. So it's really very few photons that are actually arriving all this way. So this is actually a novel concept, and this was the second telescope in the world using that concept, where you have a fixed angle instead of being able to follow the star all the way. It's tilted at 37 degrees. And then, because it uses a spherical mirror, you can actually, any part of the mirror is the same. So you can actually use parts of the mirror and track over here. So if this thing is parked like that, and there's a star at infinity, the light comes in, it focuses here, but as that star moves, this focal point will shift. And it actually follows a spherical path on that thing. So there's a tracker then that actually follows that path. And that's the only moving part. But that's still 2.5 tons that has to be controlled very precisely to that 6 micron accuracy. What this picture is really representing is we have this tower which is used to align the mirrors optically. So in the beginning of the evening, there's a very special instrument there that shines laser light onto the mirrors. They reflect it back, and they have to be aligned to within 0.3 of an arc second. Now, I don't know if you know how much that is, but basically, if you took one of those mirrors and put a stick on the end on the mirror that's a kilometer long, you're talking about 0.3 millimeters at the end of that stick. That's the accuracy with which you need to align them so that they perform as though they are optically one surface. That's what you're after. And you need to keep it there. Even though this is a steel truss that they're mounted on, even though this is exposed to atmosphere, because it's obviously open, but there are other reasons to expose it to atmosphere, and the steel truss expands about 8 millimeters, I think, through the night. Okay, so you need to compensate for all of that. But anyway, what's good about this concept is you get about 70% of the sky because you have this 12-degree donut, but all this, because the Earth rotates, 70% of the stars move through the donut at some stage or another. But it only costs 20% of the cost of a traditional telescope. And that's why South Africa could afford actually to participate in such a huge project or a huge telescope, and we didn't need to follow a traditional design. So this is a bit of a artist's impression. I don't know, have any of you ever visited SALT? Okay, so some of you have been there. So that is sort of what it looks like. Just the different parts, the center of curvature sensor, the optical payload, you can see there, and the tracker is the moving part. The payload is really where all the light ends up. So that's where the sensors are, the different scientific instruments. And underneath, we have the sort of control room and buildings and stuff. And in the middle, a thermally stable room where we also take some of the light through an optical fiber for some very sensitive instruments which stay at the bottom. And that room has a spec of no more than 1 degree temperature variation through the year. So it has to be very stable. We started digging the ground at about in September, if I remember correctly. And we had to go down. This was for the tower, the foundation for the tower. We had to go right down onto rock, because that tower, even in under wind conditions, wasn't allowed to shake. And it's actually two concentric tubes. The outer one keeps the wind out away from the inner tube, which actually has the instrument on, and they actually have separate foundations and lots of stuff like that. So that's where I learned a little bit about civil engineering. The most important objective is a good image quality. So the more you can concentrate that light onto one spot, let's say it's a CCD where it ends up, the more energy there is, the more likelihood there is of you actually detecting it. If it's smeared over more pixels, then you need a lot more light to actually go above the noise threshold. So it's all about image quality. I've actually mentioned some of these sort of key challenges. I've mentioned most of them. Perhaps the last bullet is important, a thing called dome seeing. Many people ask, why were the telescopes built at Sutherland? And if you look at the stars at night, you will see that they flicker a little bit. It's as a result of the light coming through the atmosphere, and you actually have hot and cold air mixing, which has a refractive index then, and it bends the light. But it's varying all the time, so you get this flickering. Obviously, if that light is ending up on a sensor, it's going to smear. So you don't want that. So there was a lot of research done, I think, in the 30s, before they built the first telescopes there. And Sutherland was a good place because there's a lot of laminar flow of air, so you get stratification and it's a lot better. But now, when you build your telescope, you mustn't disturb this perfect environment. So obviously you cannot have heat sources, but not just active heat sources like electronics and motors and computers and things like that and people. You also cannot have passive heat sources like concrete, like steel, because the telescope wants to be at ambient. For you to not have any of this effect, everything needs to be kept at ambient, and ambient changes through the night. In fact, sort of afternoon to morning variation at Sutherland can be 20 degrees. And everything that is exposed to the atmosphere should be following the temperature as accurately as possible. So I did write a few impossible specifications that caught me out later, such as something should not radiate and it should not reflect light within this visible wavelength. But then I learned very quickly that paint, what it doesn't absorb, it reflects. So you you have the one or the other. And there's a lot of detail that went into actually achieving that, which I don't have time to go into now, but I'll touch on it in a minute. But we built these louvers into the building, which gave you free flow of air through the building to keep it cool during the night. But it's basically a huge fridge. During the daytime, it's air-conditioned to the predicted temperature, 8 o'clock in the evening. So we've got sort of complex weather prediction models that uses data from the South African Weather Service, predicting that temperature all the time, and then through the day, the set point of the air conditioning is adapted. And then when the telescope opens, which is normally 6, 7, it's a bit colder, and then by 8 o'clock, everything is stabilized, and they can start the observation. So to chase that specification, one of the first things we had to do was to develop an image quality error budget. So adding up every single little thing that can contribute to bad quality. And this is the amount of smearing in arcseconds. So an arcsecond is a measurement of an angle on the sky. Okay, it's 1/3600th of a degree. So it's quite a small angle, but that's how much smearing you get at Sutherland in as a median over the various conditions at Sutherland. So we said, okay, let's aim for a telescope which does not degrade that significantly. So we will go for half that number, so that in the end, the telescope performance will be a 1.3. And then we said, okay, what actually adds up into that? There's the actual optical performance of the telescope. There is now the contribution of the dome and the facility to this atmospheric distortion or atmospheric effect. And then there's the payload positioning, which is sort of dynamic effect that you've got moving parts that are perhaps not perfect. And even though the optics are perfect, your system is not contributing. And then each of these have a whole tree under them where you end up with something physical. Like on the structure, for example, in fact, I have some of them here. Okay, that translates to 100 microns on the focal plane. Sorry about the typo. The mirrors being aligned to 50 nanometers. The tracker, or the spherical aberration corrector, and its deformation over the full operating scope. The tracker, which is the 2.5-ton structure, has to be controlled to 6 microns. And then this 80-ton structure, can't move during an observation. So that's despite the wind, despite seismic activity, and electric motors and compressors and stuff which are in the vicinity. And then to actually achieve this dome facility seeing, what we calculated and by looking at what other telescopes have done, we came up with a number, magic number of 2 degrees C, said everything exposed must be within 2 degrees Celsius of ambient. Which was not that easy to actually achieve. The other challenge was telescope efficiency. A normal telescope that follows a star throughout the night has basically got the whole night to observe something. Here we have 12 degrees, which depending on where you are in the sky is anything between 30 minutes and 1.5 hours. That's the total time that you have. And the scientists are used to basically keeping the shutter open for that full period, depending on how faint they want to go. So what we don't want to do is to lose time by rotating the telescope, by finding an object, because you will now be doing different observations through the course of the night. And SALT is a Q-scheduled telescope, which means the scientific community actually don't come here. They sit in their comfy offices in the United States. They apply for time on the telescope through an internet tool. They do a simulation, and then it ends up on a queue, and then there are actually operators and astronomers at the telescope that actually do the observation and then send them their data. So efficiency is really costing money because all these shareholders have paid for their time on the telescope and they actually want data. So one of the things we did is we just developed a timeline, which is not rocket science, but for them this was fantastic because nobody had ever done that before on the telescopes. And so we just looked at the different activities of different systems and the operator, and there they go through the process, they select an object, the tracker slews to where it must be, because what's not shown there is obviously you need to calculate where everything needs to go. The structure lifts, it rotates, it lowers, and it's on air bearings, which keep it afloat on a very flat surface. And then you start tracking, and then you go into a guidance. It's normally open loop up to some point, and then you do image processing to find an object which is bright, and then you lock onto that object, and that gives you the more accurate tracking. So some of the challenges just relating to the system engineering, this was unfamiliar territory to the customer. As I said, they were not, the South African customer was not that technology literate. The team had never built a telescope before. What we were doing is really pushing the limits of physics. I mean, 50 nanometers is not much. To physically align things and keep them aligned. And that's just one of the specifications. We had multiple contracts from across the world. There's a lot of software that had to be developed. We had a fixed budget and schedule, even before the engineering was done. A lot of reliability. It's supposed to operate 365 nights a year. The efficiency. And so it needed a proper process. And it was a once-off development. There's no production afterwards. There's no prototyping. You've got one chance, and you've got to do it. Do it right. So you've seen this graph about influencing the final cost. And I was really glad I managed to convince the team that this is what we should do, spend a lot of time system engineering in the beginning. So although the initial schedule had groundbreaking, I think, in month 5, eventually I had my system spec finished by month 9, and groundbreaking was quite a bit later. And actually, I think we had groundbreaking shortly after that, because some of the civil stuff I managed to give them the specs on earlier. We followed a fairly basic, just waterfall development process at the system level, and it really worked well. And so I'm not going to bore you by taking you through that, but we really did do this. So we had, and in the end, I've got a slide just talking about the verification. We did have specifications. We did not have very many specifications at this level. At this level. We had a system spec. We had subsystem specifications. It was mostly within contractor hands. Many contractors did not have system engineering experience. So it was a bit of a battle. The civils people really, really protested very strongly, but eventually they even did an acceptance test, and a nice little table. We met the specification, and they found many, many mistakes because they're not used to being checked up so carefully. It was worthwhile. This is the system breakdown structure. So I've sort of touched on each of those up to now. The system engineering activity, quite a breadth of activity. I don't expect you to read this. But this, for me, was quite an eye-opening experience, is actually doing a functional flow diagram for something like this, and it was very, very valuable. To actually, the different colors are different systems, okay, or subsystems. To actually draw those colored lines after the fact. So it was really to do the functional allocation. I did this block diagram. These are all variables or information data that's being distributed between different systems. There's real time stuff. There's stuff that's not that critical from a timing point of view, and whatever the different color codes. But then to be able to say, okay, what makes sense to simplify the interfaces for the dome is that's it, and actually come up with a sort of a philosophy which really simplified the interfaces immensely, and gave the supplier enough control so that they could commission their system and test it in their factory. So each of those systems did need a control system of their own. We couldn't centralize that because there were certain specifications or requirements that we wanted to sign off at the supplier level. We couldn't take responsibility for that. Yeah, so this is just zooming into one little corner where we have the tracker, sort of what it looks like. This is the computer architecture, and yes, we used PCs for all this real-time control. That was quite a contentious decision, and we actually used Ethernet for our data communication. Now, for those of you that know, Ethernet is not very predictable from a latency point of view, so normally real-time people don't like that. But it's extremely cost-effective, and there's so many associated things that you can buy for PCs and whatever that we chose to do that. So we used Windows 2000, which was another very contentious thing, because the astronomer community prefer Linux. But to find Linux programmers with embedded experience of this nature, to find access controllers, for example, that actually plug into a PC that works that has Linux drivers, I can carry on and on, quite difficult. So we ended up using LabVIEW as our software programming language, very high level, using software engineers, not IT specialists, to write the software. And eventually we got away with 8 people, whereas one of the telescopes that I've worked with in the Canary Islands of similar complexity, they had 38 engineers. I don't want to go into that too much. So this is what the primary mirror system looked like at some stage before it was fully populated, the different segments that are aligned there. So the big gray pipes are the steel structure. The tracker is on the top right here. This is what the truss would look like on the primary mirror. So it's individual steel pipes that twist into these balls. But it's not as simple as it looks, because you know at some stage you need to get something in, and there's already something that side and already something that side. And you need to lock it there. And the tolerancing on these nodes where the mirrors come in was, I think, around about 1 millimeter. But what is really complicated is the fact that you're not allowed to have any hysteresis. In other words, this must all act as one solid body. So bolts don't like that, because there's always a bit of stiction. So when there's a bit of thermal expansion, they creep and whatever, which means it moves. And if you get something like that happening during the night, the mirror in that vicinity will go out of alignment. So there was a lot of detail that went into designing the bolt fastenings, how you lock them, and whatever. And BKS did an excellent job in actually getting that sorted out. To keep the mirrors aligned, you know, you go to this tower in the beginning of the night, but then you need to keep them aligned. They each had 3 actuators on a pivot system that would be able to control that mirror throughout the night. And these are the edge sensors, which were stuck on the edges of the mirror, that actually pick up the relative motion between adjacent mirrors. And they actually had to measure then that 50 nanometers of measurement, of movement. And what is interesting, I did not think it would be possible, but the gap between the mirrors varies between about 10 millimeters and 24 millimeters. So you're talking about 2 plates like this, which are that far apart, being able to detect a 50 nanometer motion in this direction, not like this, with a capacitive effect. Needless to say, that was one of the things that ended up not working that well. It worked well in the lab, but it was very sensitive to humidity. The initial tests that were done, it did not seem a problem, but then it's one of the things that we just could not solve. So SALT has actually retrofitted those now with inductive sensors, or they're still busy actually, which was quite a costly mistake. This is now looking at the mirror from the back. He has the truss. This is just a tool that was developed to actually insert the mirror, and this is really a sort of one of the design drawings of the tool. But here you have the mirror mount. When you have the actual mirror segment, there's a thing called print through, which is very, very small, but when you rest that thing on the surface, it actually bends. So you get bumps forming on the front surface. So they were actually polished on a truss like that, so that those bumps are actually polished out. And then it has to be kinematically mounted, otherwise the forces aren't equal. And so each of these have three points, and then this rests on a lever arm system, and these are the mechanical actuators from a German company. Very high precision actuators, but then you take it through a levering system, which gives you even greater accuracy. And this is what it looked like actually going in to the truss. A lot of fun crawling around that big jungle gym. Okay, the building. I mentioned some of the stuff by now. That's really, I think, the sort of key parts of the building, if you just ignore the steel structures in front. And we had to do a lot of analysis to get to that 2 degrees requirement. This was one of the models looking at the wind flow through the building. It was done by TF Design here in Stellenbosch. And also looking at the force of the wind on the mirror and seeing whether there would be motion of the mirror as a result of those wind forces. And trying to design how we would control the louvers so that you get a flow out of the dome opening and actually get to a good distribution of the temperatures. This is just looking at the wind on a particular segment. And then these are the temperatures. So in this particular picture, you can see this 273 going up to 274. So there's a 1.2 degree difference between the maximum and the minimum as predicted by that model. If you get that much airflow going through. I don't think we quite achieved that. Although we did a lot of infrared camera work afterwards to try and find hotspots and actually see if we met that. But it is one of the things that worked very well. Just to give you one interesting thing, the concrete floor obviously has a lot of heat capacity. And what they thought of, which I think was very clever, is to put a steel floor 10 centimeters above this floor and then have a big hole here, and there's a duct system in here which sucks out the air and ejects it about 50 meters downwind from the building, so that you're actually drawing in this air and it's going under the steel, so the steel is actually at ambient, but the concrete below can be a lot warmer, but it's not exposed to the atmosphere. This is just indicating some of the things that had to be done to keep the atmosphere undisturbed. We built these igloos, which are really refrigeration systems, well, refrigerated cabinets for all the electronics, control electronics on the telescope. That's my son. A few years ago, he's 23 now, studying at Stellenbosch. And what he's standing on is the so-called pier, which is the concrete surface that the telescope rotates on. I'm going to tell you more about that in a minute. This is the dome going onto the top of that tower. Some very brave people. The concrete surface had to be extremely flat, because you're rotating the telescope and then parking it at a particular location. What you don't want is to have a lot of angular errors coming in every time it parks. You can compensate for that. Yes, you can have a lookup table that you've calibrated at the different angles, but it had four legs, so you were getting it was not a kinematic system, so you'd get twisting of the structure, which would then go through to the mirror and misalign it and whatever. So the civil contractors told us this was the flattest piece of concrete in South Africa. It had to be flat within 1 millimeter over its entire surface. And they're used to working at round about 1 centimeter would be a high tolerance for a civil engineer. And it didn't work the first time, so we actually had to take off the surface and do it a second time. And this was the first time, and you can see flaking of the upper surface and there was quite a tight specification on the impact resistance of that surface to prevent wear and tear. So this was the structure going in. Fortunately, that piece didn't weigh 80 tons, but that was very, very heavy, and it had to be lifted into the building. And just before that, the base structure was lifted in. Lots of very clever and dangerous rigging work that had to take place to do that. And this was the base structure just before that came in on top of that. And there you can see the pier very nicely that the structure rests on. And it had a big central bearing. And in the middle here, there's a hole and all the pipes and stuff. No, correction. All the optical fibers that go to the instrument room would go through there. There's a big cable wrap here that had all the cooling and the electrics and instrumentation going through there. This is one of the air bearings before it was put in operation. So it's basically just like a hovercraft. It's amazing that 8 of these things can lift this 80-ton effortlessly. And it just rides on that air cushion, and then you just deflate that and it just goes down very, very nicely. The dome, it's big. And it is made out of aluminium to make it light enough to lift and whatever. This was it being lifted on. It snowed that day. Actually, quite nice. There's snow inside the telescope as well. The tracker, I've explained to you that it sort of tracks the stars as they move across the sky. So here you see what the optical payload is looking at. So it's really got a spherical aperture, and it starts off using that part of the mirror, and then as the star moves across the sky, it shifts up, and at some stage it can use the entire mirror, and then it uses less and less on that side. So you're not getting the full benefit for the entire track, but you can track something for a long period of time. And the shadow, you don't see that in the image because you focused on infinity, so this actually just equates to lost light. But some of the difficulties there, perhaps a bit on the timing, the 1 millisecond absolute. They're very good models that tell you exactly where every star is, every moment. So you've got these databases with, no, not every star, the brightest couple of million. And so we would normally use the brightest stars as guide stars. So the stars that are being observed or the galaxies or whatever would not necessarily be on a database like that. But we would know what their RA index is, in other words, what their coordinates are. And then we would find within that area a bright star which we would use to guide on. But to find that, we need to know time very accurately, and that needs to go all the way to the tracker. And I said just now we were using Ethernet, and Ethernet's got a jitter of up to 170 milliseconds. Okay, so that doesn't really allow you to, in real time, tell the tracker, go to this position and it will find a star. So the philosophy that we followed was to actually predate the information. In other words, we would send the tracker information for the next 20 seconds in an array, and it would interpolate, and then we would send it the exact time. And as part of that array, we would say, by that time, be there, by that time, be there, which had a huge simplification effect on the entire design of the telescope, because that was the only system that needed to know exactly what the time is and what it's doing. And so we had very accurate GPS time. Oh, and of course, the instruments need to know that because they need to record it as part of the data, but they didn't really have to move that accurately. This was the tracker for the Hobby Eberle telescope, which I haven't mentioned yet. It was the first telescope that was built with a similar concept of a fixed angle in Texas. So we had the advantage of being able to go there and see what they did wrong and what they did right, obviously. And so a lot of the stuff is not stuff that we invented that we can take credit for. But there were many, many significant improvements that we could make because they were following sort of traditional telescope design principles. We came in without having done this before, and we realized, you know, we don't know how to do this. Let's just try something. This is the tracker being commissioned at Roytec Radar Systems during our acceptance testing. This is the payload from a bit closer. So this is a carbon fiber, a carbon composite structure, honeycomb. This is the spherical aberration corrector hanging at the bottom here. So that's where the light comes in. The instruments are all fitting within this, or on top. And it's big. There you can see one of the engineers standing there. This is a linear actuator, six of them. No, not six. Yeah, six. We call it the hexapod. So that would provide tip and tilt to this structure and focus, whereas the carriage would give you the X and the Y movement. Just a bit about the optic design. So the light is coming in from the mirror. This is now the spherical aberration corrector. It was at four mirror segments. Very, very well aligned and very specifically designed. They were very expensive to manufacture because they had crazy surfaces which were outside the normal manufacturing processes. But eventually, then it would give you a sharp focus of light coming from a spherical mirror. And then what you would normally do is introduce here a mirror which could deflect the light into different locations for the different instruments. So that's how we could get the light to different instruments. And that is the one thing that went wrong as well in the process. The mirrors individually were all kinematically mounted because they enclosed in a steel structure, in a steel tube, and you don't want to introduce any twist into that. But when that spherical aberration corrector, I'm going forward now. And I don't know which button to use here. When the spherical aberration corrector was bolted to this, this has actually got a row of bolts going all the way around. And that introduced a twist into that whole thing. And it took about 2 years to find that as the problem. And I'll show you some of the images in a moment that were distorted as a result. This is an interesting thing called atmospheric distortion compensator, which is actually two very special lenses. Obviously, you don't want to lose light, so very, very special glass that gets used. But as when you look at a sunset, the sun is red because you've got the red light separating out because it's coming through the atmosphere at an angle. And when it's vertical, it's coming through it perpendicular to the atmosphere and whatever. So if you are observing a star, it gets redder and redder, so you're actually shifting you're separating out the light components. You don't want that because part of what you're trying to observe is the qualities coming from the star, the photons. So what this does is it actually rotates with elevation angle, and its setting is exactly correlated to the height above the horizon, and it basically just does that redshift back into the image again. This is one of the instruments that went onto that payload, the so-called high-resolution spectrograph. This was done by the University of Wisconsin. They have a lab there called the Jet Propulsion Lab, JPL. You may have heard of them. They do a lot of work for NASA. They built this instrument, and it was installed after the project was completed, so I didn't actually see that myself. Just a few words about the control system. I've mentioned a lot of the details there, but this is what was in the spec, basically, for the control system. This is what we want. To get the efficiency, I wanted it to be point and click. And astronomers were used to Linux, so they would have a command line interface, and it would take them half an hour to get to a star. I said, no, the technology is there, point and click. These would then be the stars that are being observed. There's an instrument which has a slit, which is what you've got there. So typically beforehand, the person wanting this observation would have specified exactly what that looks like. He would have chosen certain guide stars as bright stars. Three gives you the orientation as well as the position, so that throughout the observation you could use those for positioning purposes. Sorry, I'm lying to you. There's the guider. These were shown as recognized stars from the database, so that you can identify that you're on the field. It's not that simple when the sky looks that dense, but it's a tiny segment like this because you're seeing all these faint objects. You do need some cues to help you find the right star, and that's what those are about. This is what it eventually looked like. The image on the left is not a salt image. It was put there for test purposes. I'll show you some of the salt images in a moment. But one of the real challenges was to try and simplify the information going to the operator and the astronomer. The operator would typically be somebody at a technician level. And that person, it's their responsibility to point the telescope at the star and keep it there throughout the observation. They're not worried about the science. Their problem is the telescope. And then next to them, that was the operator screen. Next to them would be the astronomer, and they're operating the instruments and getting the information about what is the science that is needed and operating the instruments. But you need to minimize the information going to that person. So we said, okay, there's a flow throughout the night. So at the top there, you have the tabs, day operations, set up in the evening, next target, acquisition, which is the moment that you're actually finding yourself on the sky, guidance, and you sort of repeat through these steps throughout the night, and then there's shutdown in the morning, sort of a maintenance page, and an operator log where they can insert certain comments and things like that. And so this would be the acquisition page. There you would see the yellow green line is where the tracker has moved through the night in the observation, or where it is moving, certain manual controls, things about the light and whatever. I don't want to go into that. We had individual design reviews, a preliminary design review and a critical design review on each of these systems, and going down even in more detail where possible. And that was really, I guess, one of the most valuable things we could do, because we couldn't apply the or enforce the process, but we could sit in a design review with a supplier and say, did you think about this? Show us this document, da 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 da. A very important tool to actually get what we needed. So in the verification process, sorry, the red circles don't really mean each. They come from a presentation which I did previously. But we did go through those processes. We're at the supplier, we would do that, and then we had these final integrated system ATPs at the telescope, and then actual trial operation where it was operated by the astronomers and by the operational staff, and they had to sign off that everything was working. I'm not going to go through that. I think our time is basically up. We did have a verification cross-reference matrix. It's actually interesting. The astronomers hated me at some stage because I was forcing them to put things in writing, to agree to something, to not change their minds and whatever. But when we got to this phase, they loved me because they now had a handle on how to force the engineers to give them what they wanted. It was a very painful process, but it was really necessary. So we went back to the spec, and even at the system level, subsystem level, looked at the individual requirements, and what's not shown there in the reference column, we had individual test procedures, and it wasn't 100% coverage. I guess our coverage was probably 80%. but it had added a huge amount of value to what we had. There was a committee that was signing off the individual tests. They were really representing the customer, and they had to really say that they are happy. And there was an understanding, and I think I should say this. A telescope like this, it took us 5 years. The closest other example is about a seven-year project, and it was less complex. And the Gran Tecam telescope done by Spain started before this, and I think they only finished something like 4 years ago. So there's a process. A lot of this, because you're pushing the limits of physics, there's a process of refinement. You actually have to calibrate things out. So you have to say, okay, here's the problem. You have a blurred image. What's causing it? Oh, it's this. Okay, let's write this model to model this thermal effect and see if it helps. And it's an operational issue to continually improve the telescope. So as a construction team, we had to take it to a point, but we couldn't guarantee that it's going to be finished in the timescales that we... or be perfect. And so to give you an idea, I said that the image quality is the big thing. By September 03, we have what we call so-called first light, the first time we actually had telescope light through the telescope onto a camera system. The image quality, which you'll remember, was specified as 1.3. What we measured was 5. And then it... A year later, it had come down to about 1.5. No, what is it? Yeah, about 1.5. So that first light image, that's what it looked like. The line is because these are actually two CCD detector chips next to each other. So there is actually a black spot in the middle. And later on, that was taken out in software. But that's really what it looked like. By November, that better image looked like this, still not perfect. And you can see there seem to be little tails on some of the spots on the top left there. Some of them are nice and round. And depending on how long you expose it, that will obviously be brighter or less bright. But that's good enough to do some science. But that's not what it is designed to do. And if you go to the SALT website today, you'll see this photograph of the same object. Obviously a longer exposure, but you can see how rich that area of the sky is, and how faint you actually can go now. So was it worthwhile to do system engineering? I think most definitely yes. One of the astronomers that were really criticizing me a lot in the beginning came back to me towards the end of the project and said, yeah, if it wasn't for this, nothing would have worked. So they really bought into it, and they actually, when they were appointing an operational team, the first position they were advertising was a systems engineer to actually lead the technical team on at Sutherland. I've mentioned some of the problems. Perhaps the last line there, operational staffing was underestimated. That was actually very sad. One of the first things that the people at Hobby Ebbeli Telescope told us when we started the project was, don't underestimate the complexity of operating the telescope. Appoint your operation team early so that when the construction people leave, they know how to operate and run the telescope. And so 2 years ahead of completion, we actually started saying to the observatory, listen, you need to start appointing people and whatever. They appointed one person, and I think by the time most of the team had left, I think they had 3 or 4 people of a team. It should have been about 10 people. And obviously things then, you know, there's a lot of stuff that didn't work afterwards. There was just incomplete transfer of knowledge. So this is sort of the core team. The project scientist is the funny guy on the right. Kubus Meiring is not in the picture. And that's it. Thank you. I don't know how much time we've got, but I'm open to questions if you guys have still got some time. The philosophy, if you look at sort of embedded systems, I did a lot of work on the Roy Falk there, you saw. What you do is you buy the disks, you duplicate them, you put them in the safe, and you run on that software forever. You don't try and change the operating system because there's no need to. So we chose the most stable version of Windows with a lot of really good stuff in it. We firewalled it, so there's no security updates, no stuff like that needed. And that's the software. And we've got the disks. You don't need to be compatible to the latest version of Windows. You don't, whatever. So we actually, that computer architecture, I didn't point it out, but there are two networks that were firewalled from each other. So the one, the operators and the staff would have access to. The others is back-end stuff. It's like a PLC, or it's like the control thing on an aircraft. Don't touch it. It's a technical system. Yeah, now that is definitely a thing. So there was some legacy plan, and particularly around buying stuff. And what you do have to do, I mean, yeah, there has to be upgrades and things, and they've actually now replaced those systems. We made the mistake of buying high-end desktops to do a lot of the control instead of rack-mounted computers. And that was an oversight. So they've now, I don't know how long ago, but actually put in very nice racks with decent computers and stuff. But it's mostly the original software and whatever. What is very nice is the fact that we use LabVIEW. It's not plug and play to upgrade, but LabVIEW keeps current. And so you can import your old LabVIEW code into the new LabVIEW, and the new LabVIEW is keeping up with the latest operating systems and stuff. And yes, there's then a process to make sure you haven't broken anything. But the legacy doesn't go away. It's always a problem, regardless of what you chose. Anything else? Thank you.